¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.
I'm here on the job site with Dale, who's a framing contractor.
Hey, good morning.
Dale traded up to Geico Commercial Auto Insurance for all his business vehicles. We're here where he needs us most.
Yep, they sure are.
We make it easy for him to save on all his insurance needs, all in one place, with coverage that fits his business and bottom line. Oh, I shouldn't have looked down.
It's all right.
We're so far up here.
Look at me. Take a deep breath.
Oh, I'm good. So good.
Get a commercial auto insurance quote today at geico.com and see how much you could save. It feels good to Geico.
Welcome, everybody, to Redacted on this Thursday. I'm Clayton Morris.
I'm Natalie Morris.
And on this show, we kind of peel the onion back to reveal the true story underneath and try to cut through all of the propaganda. Boy, do we have some big stories we're going to get to with some very special guests. Alexander Mercuris from the Duran is going to be joining us to dive into what is happening with Russia. Russia going on nuclear alert, saying the last time that Moscow was attacked directly was 1942. We are in a world on edge right now, so we're going to talk about everything that's happening in the war in Ukraine.
Plus, we have new revelations from Jeffrey Epstein's schedule published in the Wall Street Journal. We get to talk to Whitney Webb today about what's new, what's old, what does this mean, how many more famous and powerful people will we see walking backwards about previous statements
and with Epstein. Yeah, and we're going to talk to her about some new ideas, too, about why... Why now? Why are we hearing from the Wall Street Journal right now on this story? And what are they trying to distract us from?
Yeah.
So we'll ask Whitney Webb about that. We're also going to be looking at why we're about to, of course, face this debt ceiling debacle, which is June 1st when we hit this debt ceiling. Yesterday, Jerome Powell coming out and saying, a reporter asked him, what happens if we hit the debt ceiling? And he said, I don't even want to answer that question. He goes, that would be the stuff of nightmares. We literally cannot hit a debt ceiling and not pay our bills. But we are in an economy on fire, and we've got a special guest. Carol Roth is going to be joining us on the show. All of that, plus Juan Guaido was in Washington, D.C. Dan Cohen was the only journalist in the room asking questions. This is unbelievable. There were a lot of fireworks. We've got a very busy show on this Thursday, and Redacted starts right now. Well, we don't want to waste any time on tonight's show. So I want to say thank you to all of the hundreds of thousands of you that are subscribers to our daily newsletter. We just hit a brand new milestone, and we get constant emails back from you every day saying how much you love the daily newsletter. And it's very easy to sign up, and we bring a lot of value to you first thing in the morning over your cup of coffee. You go to redacted.inc to sign up. Then you'll receive a welcome email. You have to confirm that email. It might go to your spam folder, might go to your junk folder. And then just click confirm. And then tomorrow morning, Monday through Friday, you'll receive the newsletter first thing in the morning over your cup of coffee. And we cover like 4 or 5 of the big stories of the day in there.
That's right. It's meant as a companion piece to this show. So a lot of times we have viewers who say, where's the link to this? I want to show my so-and-so. The newsletter is a great place to keep up with where we're finding our research, where you can read it for yourself. You absolutely shouldn't trust our interpretation. You should read for yourself. We're here to have a discussion with you. We have no ego about it. Sometimes viewers point out typos, or sometimes readers ask what that link is about. We're happy to communicate with you this way. And we just hit a new record subscriber number. So we are thrilled about it. This is a project, what'd you say, the newsletter is about 3-4 years old now?
I think about, yeah. Count. Yeah, 3 or 4 years old now.
We started slightly before the pandemic.
And it was funny, we had literally one reader of the newsletter. And then
which
we had
my
like
brother-in-law.
And we had like 5 readers and then 10 readers. And now we have hundreds of thousands of you that read the newsletter every morning. And it's just so humbling and amazing. So if you would like to subscribe, it's totally free. We hope it brings a lot of value to your morning. Go to redacted.inc. That's the place to go. Redacted.inc. Drones hitting the Kremlin in an apparent assassination attempt. Putin says no one has attacked Moscow since 1942. Those are ominous words. Reports are that his nuclear arsenal is at its highest readiness that we've seen so far. And also reports that Ukraine has started its quote unquote spring offensive, or I should say NATO has started its spring offensive, that coming from the Wagner Group. We are honored. We are honored tonight to have on the host of the Duran, Alexander Mercuris, who is, I can't believe we haven't had on the show yet, but I thought what an opportune moment to have a great thinker, a great analyst, really a person who can help us cut through the fog of war and the propaganda. Alexander, it's my honor to have you here on Redacted.
Well, it is my honor to be here on Redacted, and I'm thank you very much for your very, very generous words.
Well, my pleasure. So I thought what a great place to start is with sort of the 30,000 foot level of where we're at right now, which is this attack, of course, over the past 48 hours on the Kremlin, the talk of nuclear war, the readiness of the nuclear arsenal, the spring offensive. What are your sources telling you? What is your analyst mind telling you about the moment we are in right now?
I think this is an incredibly dangerous moment. And I think whatever it was that happened around the Kremlin, and I'm not convinced, by the way, it was exactly an assassination attempt. It looks like a kind of stunt more than anything. It might also have been intended to knock the Russian flag down from the Kremlin. The building it struck is the building where the Russian flag flies over the Kremlin. But that, of course, is of enormous symbolic significance to Russians, because the part of the Kremlin that is attacked is a building known as the Senate building. And it's the building that, in Russian terms, is the nearest approximation or equivalent to the White House. It's where Russian leaders, since Lenin's day, have had their office. Lenin had his office there, Stalin has his office there, Khrushchev did, Yeltsin did, Putin does. So they've all worked from there. So it's this most famous building in the Kremlin, and it's the one, as I said, which flies the Russian flag. So imagine if a drone hit the White House, either coming close to striking the office of the president, the Oval Office, and the office that Putin uses is as famous to Russians as the Oval Office is to Americans. Stalin used it. Other people have used that same building, that same room. Or if they struck the American flag on the White House. I mean, it would be an enormous event for Americans. This is an enormous event for Russians. And of course, a lot of Russians are very, very angry. And they're taking some of the anger out on their own government. They're saying you're being too weak, you're being too soft, you're not responding strongly enough. You need to take very, very strong countermeasures. Indeed, Ukrainians, and everybody assumes it was the Ukrainians, wouldn't have done that without the support of the West. We are clearly at war with the West. We are a nuclear power. Why are we taking all this from the Americans, from the West, in the way that we are? So it's a dangerous moment. And up to now, and I know this is something that is contrary to what we hear always in the West, Putin has been a voice of relative restraint in this. He has wanted to keep the war contained in Ukraine. So almost certainly he doesn't welcome all this language, but the pressure on him is growing.
So then the response, and I think we see this in some of the reports today about the nuclear arsenal readiness, the movements there, the words of the Wagner founder saying, you know, look, we're seeing signs that these troop movements, drone movements, train movements, for all of this is coming to a head now. What is your analyst mind and sources telling you about some sort of a Russian response? And you're right about that restraint. I think we've seen regular, I think there's always this expectation that we're suddenly going to see a massive retaliation from Putin, almost immediate. Like he's some sort of mad, that's what the West wants, right? It's this like mad idea that he's mad Vlad, right? And that's what's going to happen. But it's also sort of quiet and then it's precise. What do you think is going to happen?
I think you're absolutely right about this. Now, important fact, Putin, the Russian government, held news of this attack back for 10 hours. So they clearly wanted to, you know, keep this thing under a great deal of information control. They wanted to control the release of this information. They wanted to prepare their responses. They wanted to keep, to calm the situation down as much as possible. They didn't want pictures to appear immediately on Russian television, as it can do, showing this attack. So I think Putin is going to want to exercise restraint again, despite the criticism he is coming under. And I think that he believes, and I think that the Russian political leadership, most of them believe, not all of them, and that's an important thing to remember, but most of them believe that in terms of the conflict in Ukraine, things are going their way. So they don't need to overreact. They can take time. They can choose their time to respond. And I don't think, as a result of that, we're going to see missile strikes on Kiev, people hunting Zelensky down, all of those dramatic things that one might have expected. I think the Russians will bide their time. I think that they will undertake a measured response. I think they will also try to put the United States on the back foot. They're already saying the United States is implicated in this because it is supporting this regime, as they call it, in Kiev, which is doing all of these things. And how reckless and irresponsible is that of the United States? And they're also conveying that same message to their friends around the world. And as we've seen, they're not without friends around the world. And they're going to say, look, we're the people who are rational, we're restrained, we don't want to escalate this, but the Americans, they are not being responsible. And they're going to use that in that kind of way to gain more support around the world, even more support at a time when the United States is again seeking to isolate them. But that is what Putin wants to do. The problem is, and I'm glad you mentioned Wagner, because of course there are the hardliners in Russia. Russia has its hardliners. Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is the head of the Wagner group, is a hardliner increasingly. He's becoming very vocal. He's talking about treason all across the Russian military system, that people are weak. He interprets every exercise of restraint as proof of corruption. And that those voices are getting louder and they're gaining traction. So Putin, I think, still has the authority to keep this under control. But it would be very, very reckless to assume that he can do this indefinitely.
Fascinating. And we just, you know, got word, of course, today from the office of Putin that they're blaming Washington for this attack on the Kremlin, which is not a surprise, which is not a surprise to any of us who've been following this for any length of time. Everything that's really been directed out of Ukraine has been directed by NATO and the United States. So that's not a surprise. And you're hearing increasing calls from the United States Senate. We heard from and from members of the House of Representatives in the United States. We heard from Mike McCaul of Texas saying that they have to launch a spring offensive, that our support, the United States support of Ukraine, is really contingent upon them almost pulling off a public relations move, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And I think, again, this is incredibly irresponsible because everybody who, you know, I take seriously, and there's lots of people, there's lots of commentaries about this war, but most people who have been following this war closely feel the time is working against Ukraine, that it's suffering heavy losses in manpower, heavy losses in equipment. It doesn't have a functioning air force to any great extent. Its air defense system is shot to pieces. Its economy is in free fall. There was a very, very sad article in The Guardian which is very supportive of Ukraine in this war, to put it mildly, but they were talking about the spread of poverty in Ukraine. And despite all of that, Ukraine is in effect being ordered by people in Washington to launch an offensive, which I think most military people that I've spoken to, on both sides, on the American side, I speak to some people who've been in the American military, on the Russian military, they think that it will leave Ukraine in a weaker position. Ukraine might conceivably gain some ground, but the losses it will suffer will be irreplaceable. And today, a Russian commander, a man called Alaudin, who's actually a Chechen, but he's very prominent in the Russian military, he actually said, this is going to be their last big throw. After we weather this, we will continue what we are doing at the moment. We will continue to grind them down. We will continue our attrition. And we are looking for victory. We will find, we will achieve our total victory. And he's even put a date on it. He says August to September 2024, they'll have finally run out of everything that they have. And note the timing of that, just a few months or weeks before the presidential election in the United States. And that is not a coincidence, in my opinion.
Fascinating. Yes, I think you're absolutely right about that. I'll get you out of here on these last two points, these last few points here, which is around personnel and who's left and what are your numbers? We hear a lot of conflated numbers, fake numbers being thrown around by the West about casualties and the number of Ukrainian soldiers who have been killed, who's left. We see these videos of these conscriptions, these Ukrainian conscriptors going around, pulling people out of university classes, throwing them into the meat grinder. Who is going to carry out this spring offensive? What forces do they have left to even marshal this?
Right. Now, numbers is an impossible game because nobody's giving out numbers that can be taken at all seriously. The Pentagon has also, you know, in these leaked documents, they've admitted that any numbers they're getting, they have very low confidence in. If they have low confidence in them, we shouldn't place much confidence in them either. The one thing we can say is this. Everybody, all the information that's coming out of Ukraine now is that the country has suffered enormous losses. You see photos of cemeteries with flags, full of flags of people who've been killed. You hear lots of stories about people who have been wounded. And there are anecdotal reports. And when I say anecdotal, I mean anecdotal reports from people in the know in the United States, military people who are in contact with Ukraine, that the professional army built up over 8 years by the US and the West from 2014, that most of those people who made up that army are either dead or wounded and have only limited ability to go on conducting the war. And there are also reports now that things are so bad in manpower terms that Ukraine is having to call up severely wounded men to assume command positions because it doesn't have healthy ones. So it doesn't look good. What they have done is that they have undertaken repeated mobilizations since the conflict began in February last year. And some of these mobilized men have now been sent through crash courses in Europe and in Britain. And they've been trained up to a certain level. But sometimes the level of training is just a couple of weeks long, and they're having to operate equipment like, you know, Western tanks and infantry fighting vehicles, which Ukraine has no experience using. So, yes, a force has been assembled. It's said to number around 50,000 men, which in this war is not a huge number. But anyway, they have a force. It has some level of training. It has some level of equipment, but most people who look at it feel that it's fragile, that it could easily break down in the face of determined resistance. It's very short of ammunition. The West has not been able to keep up with Ukraine's needs for shells And of course, it doesn't have proper air cover or air defenses or all of those things. So that's why you hear stories that Ukraine must win its offensive within 24 hours, achieve a breakthrough, paralyze the Russian leadership, panic the Russian military, paralyze the Russian leadership, maybe by taking out Putin. Maybe that was what that was all about.
Or the propaganda.
All the propaganda of it, but exactly. But I mean, when people are talking like that, when they're talking in that kind of way, then frankly, it doesn't look terribly optimistic about what's coming.
I likened it last night to the Doolittle raid after, of course, the attack on Pearl Harbor. You know, the Americans needed some sort of a morale boost. Why have you not struck Tokyo? Well, we couldn't. We can't. We don't have the capabilities to do it. And even if we do it, it's a suicide mission. And so we launched some, you know, we launched some drones at the Kremlin and tried to take out a flag. And then the post office releases a commemorative stamp as a sort of morale boosting PR movement. That's the way it struck me as well. And maybe it'll have the desired
result. That is exactly what it was, I think, principally. And it's a sign of weakness, ultimately, not a sign of strength. It's an important thing for people to understand. That doesn't make it any less reckless or dangerous. And going back to your earlier point about the Russians blaming the Americans for all of this, I mean, in a way, the Russians are saying to the Americans, look, you may say you've got nothing to do with it. Prove it to us. You have been supporting this regime all this time. It is doing these things. If you are saying you don't support this kind of thing, then show us, prove to us that this isn't so by taking steps, real steps, to distance yourself from the government in Kiev and perhaps taking some steps to look for a diplomatic settlement. And of course, the US won't be able to do that. And again, as I said, the Russians will be communicating all that to their friends and, of course, to people inside Russia itself.
And I'll get you out of here on this, Alexander, which is, if this is spring offensive is about to launch and all signs maybe seem to be pointing in that direction, perhaps, why are you struck? I'm just curious what your thoughts are in having the president of Ukraine not in the country at all right now.
Well, this is an extraordinary move. And I have to say, I do wonder, and I wonder whether many people also wonder whether perhaps he's been taken out of the way in case the Russians did respond to this attack on the Kremlin with some kind of act against the decision-making centers, against Zelensky himself, in other words, in Kiev. I don't for a moment think that that's what the Russians would do, but you know, people in Kiev might have been worried about that. So get the president out of the way, get him out of the country. But there might be another reason. And I have to say this, there's been an awful lot of political instability in Kiev. There was lots of people being sacked a few months ago, weeks ago. We never quite got to the bottom of that story. There's reports that Zelensky himself has been pushed in one direction, pushed in another direction. There was a rather sad article in the London Times, which said that the people around him have been trying to seek peace, that they're talking between themselves in the evening about peace. He, after all, called the Chinese president Xi Jinping to talk about peace. And then, of course, in the morning, because there were all the pressures they're coming under from their own hardliners, from people in Washington, they have to again talk about war and make all these, you know, extreme things. So I wonder whether he's been taken out of the way because he is becoming so compromised and his position is becoming so complicated. There isn't a view somewhere, either within Kiev or perhaps among some of Ukraine's friends in the West, that keeping Zelensky in Kiev at this critical time is simply going to complicate the decision-making process even more and make it even more complicated and difficult to operate than it is already.
I guess getting out of the country and going to the other decision-making places in Berlin is probably maybe a better headquarters for what you're doing right now. Alexander, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you here. Please watch, listen, read everything you can that Alexander puts out along with the great team at the Duran. We really appreciate you joining us here on Redacted. Thank you so much.
And thank you, and my great pleasure.
So thanks to Alexander. It's great having him here on the show. Really, really appreciate it. And I can see from the chat room as well that everyone really appreciated it because it's been a long time coming. And we were talking off camera about this a number of months ago when he and I were on the Gonzalo Lira show together. Like, why haven't we done a show together yet? So it seems like things are headed to a crazy spot right now. I thought, who better to have on the show than Alexander right now to talk about
it? Well, you know, it's a full moon tonight and it feels like it. The stories we're doing today are heavy and big, and a lot of times I get very overwhelmed by it, and so I have to just sort of have faith that this is all pushing us as a society to a better place. It doesn't always seem like that.
I
really appreciate those of you who have faith in something that write us and say, like, we're fighting for something. We believe in something, because I don't always feel that way. I can get dark about it.
Well, this week has been particularly crazy, right, Philip? I mean, like every piece of technology has broken this week, you know?
I woke up to thunderstorms this morning, and we don't get thunderstorms here.
Oh,
wow.
So it was like, it's just an ominous day all around.
It is.
Yeah.
So thanks to Alexander for breaking that down for us. All right. Well, we've got more news to get to here on the show. We're going to be speaking with Whitney Webb in just a few moments here about these new Epstein document revelations. Really some amazing stuff in here, but also what's not being said, what's being kept from us. We're going to go through that in just a moment. But first, it's no secret. If you're tuned in, you know the experts are seeing a recession, right? We are in the middle of one, frankly. Layoffs already happening. Small banks collapsing. Look at Pacific West Bank. I mean, it's a disaster. And yesterday, Jerome Powell, of course, announcing a new interest rate hike and basically saying, we're done. We have really nothing else that we can do. Like, we're done. We are not in a crazy hyperinflationary period anymore, but we've just got to wait probably for a couple of years to try to get back down to 3%, 2%. That means the value of the US dollar continues to decline. And today, gold hit a new record. Unbelievable gold hitting brand new. It's been nibbling at these all-time highs. Gold today is now worth more than 70 of the world's government fiat currencies. Think about that for a minute. Government currencies, gold is beating all of them right now. And so now is a time to make sure that you're invested in precious metals, gold, silver. And our friends over at Lear Capital can help you get set up right now. Natalie and I are huge investors in gold and silver. This is a huge part of our portfolio, making sure that we own actual physical gold. And Lear Capital can help you do that. All you need to do is call their 800 number, and they can, even if you have like an old IRA or an old 401k sitting around, they can actually convert that into a self-directed gold account and gold IRA. That's amazing. So you control it. You have total checkbook control of your future, not Wall Street. So call their 800 number, which is right there on your screen. It's 1-800-613-3557, or go to learredacted.com. Again, that 1-800 number, 1-800-613-3557, or go to learredacted.com. Get your free gold and silver investor guide, and right now you can receive up to $15,000 in free bonus metals with a qualified purchase. So once again, call their 800 number, 1-800-613-3557, or go to learredacted.com. Well, another day, another round of documents and revelations around Jeffrey Epstein. Now people who downplayed their relationship with Jeffrey Epstein are continuing to have to answer for it. The Wall Street Journal is out with part two of their sort of bombshell revelations about Jeffrey Epstein. First, it was his calendars. Now new documents are emerging about Bill Gates and Woody Allen and deeper dives on all of this stuff. And for that, we want to turn to investigative journalist Whitney Webb, who, of course, has written a two-volume book on the deep state mafia and the Jeffrey Epstein connections and running the sort of government, shadow government that we see, and has been diving into these documents. Whitney joins us. You just wrote a new piece on Noam Chomsky and the questions surrounding, you know, why was Noam Chomsky meeting with Jeffrey Epstein and those revelations. But first, like at a high level, Whitney, I just want to get your response to the second Wall Street Journal dumping of documents. And the other day I asked you when you were on earlier this week with the first round of this, you know, why now? Why are we learning about this now? And where did the Wall Street Journal get these documents? We were talking before the show a little bit here. You have some new theories. I'd love to hear them.
Yeah. So the Wall Street Journal, as far as it has, you know, regarding how it got these documents, as far as I've seen, there's been no transparency there, and none of the documents that they've reported on have been released, and it's still not clear how they obtained them or from whom, and or why it's coming out now. So the second part that came out today that you're referring to has a lot of names that are not really that new in relation to the Epstein scandal. You know, people like Larry Summers, Glenn and Ava Dubin, you know, Bill Gates, of course. You know, these are names that have been circulating around Epstein since at least 2019, if not earlier. Now, I've had a little more time to think about why they might be putting this out there now, and I think the answer may be to take heat off of the four billionaires who were subpoenaed as part of this U.S. Virgin Island J.P. Morgan Epstein case, because those are very astounding. So one of the more astounding ones, there's two that really stick out there. One is Sergey Brin, the Google co-founder. And the other one is Michael Ovitz, who used to be head of Walt Disney and a top talent agent for Hollywood. So, so the fact that those two individuals were subpoenaed by the USVI, which is in possession of lots of documents about Epstein's activities in JP Morgan and how they relate to his sex trafficking activities, the fact that they subpoenaed four billionaires, the other two are Thomas Pritzker of Hyatt Hotels, whose family has longstanding intelligence and organized crime connections that I detail in my book. And then the other one is Mort Zuckerman, who bought the New York Daily News after Robert Maxwell's death, Maxwell having been the previous owner, and Zuckerman was known to frequent Epstein's townhouse. You know, a lot of that isn't necessarily that revelatory on that end, but having the Google co-founder be that close to Epstein and having a former Walt Disney president being that close to Epstein are pretty significant. And as far as the Disney ties go, when Ovitz was head of Disney, the head of the Imagineering department at Disney was a guy named Bran Farron. And while Farron was in that role at Disney, he was advising the U.S. military, intelligence, all sorts of shady actors. And he brought to the Imagineering department close associates of Epstein, like Marvin Minsky and Danny Hillis, who were very closely involved with the development of military supercomputers, creating artificial intelligence, all sorts of very odd things. And the fact that they'd be involved in a company like Disney, which of course targets mainly children. And of course, Minsky was named, for example, as being a key part of the sex trafficking operations by people like Virginia Giuffre, for example. This is pretty astounding. So the fact that we're having these names come out with the Wall Street Journal piece, you know, people are now instead talking about Noam Chomsky, talking about Bill Gates, and not talking about these people who have been subpoenaed in a legal case about Epstein's sex trafficking network. You know, no one's talking about them. Instead, it's talking about these meetings on their calendars, right? And so like someone like Chomsky, who, as far as the Wall Street Journal reported, had three meetings with him, that I don't see that as being as significant, for example, as, you know, these four billionaires who have been subpoenaed, but that's getting no coverage. So I would suspect it's to take heat off of some of these guys, if you ask me. But then again, there are some important revelations here. And I think the bulk of those revelations, at least ones that are new, were in the first installment of this recent round of Wall Street Journal reporting. But in the second piece, I do think it's pretty interesting that they keep bringing up the fact that Epstein was describing himself as being a money manager for Bill Gates. I think that definitely needs to be pursued. And I think one of the reasons that mainstream media even will not do that isn't just because of how extensively Gates funds a lot of mainstream media outlets, but is also related to the fact that if you look at Epstein's history, he's tied to a series of Microsoft top executives who flew on his plane in the 1990s and who connected him with MIT Media Lab, for example, and all sorts of other activities, you know, were very much involved with his what he was doing and apparently his sex trafficking activities. Actually, Nathan Mervold, the chief technology officer of Microsoft who flew on Epstein's plane in the late 90s, was named by Alan Dershowitz actually as a person that abused minors that Epstein trafficked. That's astounding.
And Alan Dershowitz, yeah, who won't even answer questions about it when confronted and asked questions about it.
Yeah. So he says, oh, you know, you shouldn't, I didn't do anything with Virginia Roberts, Dershowitz, in this line, in this particular interview he gave. He said, you know, oh, I wasn't doing that. And then refers instead to like, maybe you should look at Nathan Mervold. who Virginia Roberts had also named, right? So that's very extreme, and there's been no interest in pursuing him, right? And he was, you know, chief technology officer of Microsoft, very, very close to Bill Gates, obviously. And another top Microsoft executive, Linda Stone, hired a woman from Epstein's entourage as her secretary, and is the person that connected him to the MIT Media Lab, which, if you believe a lot of what's in these Wall Street Journal revelations, was a key reason for a lot of these people, including Chomsky, meeting with Epstein related to his activities in and around MIT. So
I want to go back
again,
to the... Yeah, no, I was going
to
say, I just want to circle back on the Bill Gates piece of this. It is interesting to your point that the four billionaires who are involved in this lawsuit, you know, in an effort to take the heat off of them. And I think you're absolutely right about that. That makes a lot of sense. But Bill Gates, his name keeps getting brought up and up and up. And I'm stunned by that. So I want to kind of go back to that point that they make in this piece. Gates has repeatedly said that he just liked to have dinner with Epstein, what, 36 times? And then these new reports show that he vetted legal counsel. That Epstein vetted legal counsel for the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and that he told people that he was, quote, managing money for Mr. Gates, which is really interesting. That seems to me a new revelation. The spokespeople for Bill Gates continue to insist that Epstein totally misrepresented his relationship when talking to other people. So what do you make of this Bill Gates revelations?
Yeah. So again, the mainstream media narrative refuses to say that the Epstein Gates relationship precedes 2011, which again, I think is all about protecting greater scrutiny of the Epstein Microsoft ties and also the Maxwell family ties to Microsoft that took place around in the 1990s when that sort of team up took place. But the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has a lot to answer for when it comes to Epstein, including before 2011. One of the top science advisors for that foundation was a woman named Melanie Walker that Epstein recruited into his network in 1992. And she was his science advisor after he apparently paid for some of her graduate studies. And that was in the late 90s. And shortly thereafter, she has a brief stint with the World Health Organization and then is hired to be a science advisor to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, where she introduces Epstein to another science advisor of the Gates Foundation, Boris Nikolic. And if you remember, Boris Nikolic, when Epstein died, was actually the backup executor to Epstein's will. So why would Epstein have put Nikolic in that position? And these are all ties that predate Epstein and Gates' alleged first meeting per mainstream media in 2011. And then there's the added fact that UK mainstream media in the year 2000 said that Epstein made his money because of his business links to Donald Trump, Leslie Wexner, and Bill Gates. So how would they be able to say that Epstein made his millions by business ties with Bill Gates if they didn't meet for 10 years after the fact? It doesn't make any sense. And why would Gates hire someone like Melanie Walker, whose resume at that point was being science advisor for Jeffrey Epstein? You would have to know who Epstein was and what kind of science he was into. And of course, there's a lot of overlap between the science that Epstein was into and the science that Bill Gates is into.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. There's a few other names in this second report that I wanted to ask you about. Reid Hoffman, billionaire venture capitalist, LinkedIn co-founder, apparently visited Epstein's private island. And then it also stayed over in his Manhattan townhouse. Woody Allen, as you mentioned, attended dozens of dinners with his wife at Epstein's mansion and invited Epstein to his film screenings. Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, visited Epstein dozens of times and was on his private jet on a regular basis. And then Leon Black, the billionaire co-founder of private equity giant Apollo Global Management, more than 100 meetings with Epstein from 2013 to 2017. What do you make of those names?
Oh, there's a lot to say about all of those names, because these are just adding to the already known revelations about these people's ties with Epstein. So in the case of Leon Black, that was actually investigated by his investment or hedge fund, Apollo Global Management, which he has since resigned from. But the person that investigated his ties was a guy named Buzzy Krongard, who's an ex-CIA guy that was tied to insider trading on 9/11. So, I mean, it seems like that was probably a big cover-up, to say the very least. And Leon Black had entrusted almost as much of his money to Epstein as someone like Leslie Wexner had, you know, to a slightly lesser extent, was managing a lot of his estate, was managing his tax planning, which again, Epstein's role in tax planning for elites goes back to his time at Bear Stearns in the late 70s and early 80s when he was, as you know, already engaged in financial criminality. And apparently helping billionaires, you know, engage in mass tax evasion. So, you know, that obviously raises some question marks there. And Leon Black, along with Glenn Dubin, were added to the board of this school at Harvard that Leslie Wexner essentially created through his financing that David Gergen runs. At the Harvard Kennedy School, the Center for Public Leadership, which is openly allied with the World Economic Forum's Young Global Leaders Program, and a bunch of, you know, these Epstein cronies and Wexner cronies, I guess, by extension, got added to the board. So you have like Dubin and Black, and of course, Epstein and Larry Summers, a lot of people that pop up in the second part of this Wall Street Journal revelation, all swimming around Harvard. And then you have the MIT connections popping up in both of these recent revelations as well. So that's worth considering. And as far as Ehud Barak goes, the Wall Street Journal declined to note that the Daily Beast, which is considered mainstream media, reported that Barak was seen so frequently at the apartments where trafficked girls were housed, which is owned by OSA Properties, which involves a bunch of former Jeffrey Epstein employees and is run by his brother, Mark Epstein. Barak spent the night there. You know, all sorts of dubious connections between Barak and the sex trafficking scandal that did not make it into the Wall Street Journal report
right.
And are add some important context, I think is pretty clear. And of course, when it comes to Woody Allen, I'm sure most people are probably familiar with his past scandals, including the fact that his ex-partner, actress Mia Farrow, he is alleged, and it's been extensively corroborated by witnesses and other sources, that he sexually molested her adopted daughter, Dylan Farrow, at least when she was 7 years old, but according to court documents, took a sexual interest in her when she was between the ages of 2 and 3. And his current wife is actually another one of Mia Farrow's adopted children that Woody Allen met when she was a child, though his current wife, Soon-Yi Previn, maintains they didn't have their first quote-unquote friendly interaction until she was a teenager. And her Woody Allen's relationship with Mia Farrow ended when she found nude photographs of Soon-Yi Previn in his house when she was, I believe, 18 or 19 years old. So Woody Allen and Jeffrey Epstein certainly seem to have had a lot in common, and that may explain why they socialized so frequently, because obviously if you're familiar with the relationship between Soon-Yi Previn and Woody Allen, a lot of people probably didn't really want to be around that to an extent that we're actually against that type of activity, but certainly Epstein would not have been bothered by that, to say the very least. So I think that sort of explains.
That's mm-hmm. his sick jam, sadly enough. That's what he was into. Unbelievable. So, I mean, I'll get you out of here on this final question, which is in this latest round of documents, or this latest, story from the Wall Street Journal, are there still gaping holes that you would love for them to answer to fill in? Are there's things that in your reporting that you would love for them to answer for here?
Yeah, I would say release the documents. No one can verify what these documents are and what they say and what the Wall Street Journal is leaving out. Keep in mind, the Wall Street Journal, as far as I'm aware, is owned by News Corp, which is Rupert Murdoch, which recently fired Tucker Carlson for saying too much, right? So,
right.
You know.
Especially it's about fair Epstein. To say that, yeah, specifically.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's fair to say that there's probably names here that they're keeping out of the limelight for whatever reason. Because keep in mind, you know, people like Rupert Murdoch have been involved in these quote unquote deep state networks for much of his media career. And he also had a very prominent feud and rivalry with Robert Maxwell about buying, you know, building parallel media empires. So, you know. I wouldn't necessarily trust this guy or, you know, a mainstream media outlet like the Wall Street Journal. And I really think the best way forward is transparency with these documents, because according to the journal itself in these reports, they call it a trove of documents, thousands of pages, not just of his calendar and his meetings and his schedules, but emails. Release the emails.
Yeah.
You know, and this is something that's come up time and again with reporting. Why can't you just release the emails or the source documents or any of the stuff? And it very rarely happens. Frankly, I think it's definitely time for greater visibility into not just the documents themselves, but who gave them to the Wall Street Journal. You know, there's a lot of unanswered questions here that, again, a lot of people don't seem interested in asking. And I go back to what I said earlier. I think, you know, why can't they mention any of these big tech billion, especially with the Reid Hoffman revelations, right, of LinkedIn. Hoffman had been known to have taken Epstein to a big Silicon Valley meetup that involved people, some of the biggest names in Silicon Valley. Epstein allegedly knew people like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, the biggest names in tech. You, of course, have Bill Gates and Microsoft. And now Sergey Brin has been subpoenaed, and they don't note any of these Silicon Valley connections in their reporting beyond just, oh, Reid Hoffman had more meetings with Epstein than he was, you know, open about. It's a bit odd. And even with the Chomsky revelations, actually Epstein had openly said that he had invited Chomsky to his home in an interview he gave to a Science magazine journalist in 2017. And he said the reason he invited Chomsky to his home was to explicitly discuss artificial intelligence. That didn't make it into the Wall Street Journal report. So either they're not doing their homework, or, you know, they're trying to give a very limited scope of what these revelations contain. And again, you know, they'll say what the documents contain and then quickly give the statements of these people distancing themselves from Epstein. But again, you know, as my work has shown and the work of others has shown, there's a much deeper story here.
For sure. And Whitney Webb has a new article out on her website, unlimitedhangout.com, unraveling the Epstein Chomsky relationship. So I encourage you all to go and read that. We will have that linked up in the description below as well. It's always great to catch up with you. Whitney Webb, investigative journalist, thank you so much for your insight and analysis on this.
Thanks, my pleasure. And thanks for your interest in the story.
Yeah, thank you so much, Whitney. And it's amazing that the U.S. Virgin Islands story, like, there's no mainstream media coverage of these four billionaires who are a part of this massive lawsuit. Mike Ovitz of Disney. I mean, all of these, the Pritzkers.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me started about the Pritzkers.
Well, I mean, one's covering it. No one's covering that part of the story. They'd rather talk about Woody Allen, which is, of course, salacious, but this is a big part of the story.
This is a thread I want to pull in the upcoming days is this idea that Noam Chomsky is a transhumanist,
which is
what she calls the evolution of what eugenics, mm-hmm, right?
Right.
That he was interested in that. That's not something I knew about him previously. It's something I'm increasingly terrified of. And we talk about it a lot when we talk about being gender critical. And then, you know, any association with the Pritzkers is, again, proof positive of what Jennifer Bielek warns about, is the money behind transhumanism, is this idea that the human body can be upgraded and, I don't know, roboticized, fembotted. I can keep going. So I have invited Jennifer Bielek on the show. Our schedules didn't work out when we tried last time, but we're going to try again because she's somebody I'd like to continue to pull this thread with.
Absolutely. So I would love to have
Also feel. I also feel that like any media coverage of Woody Allen being, you know, a map, I guess is the word we're using. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
That's just low-hanging fruit. Like,
it's tabloid
they
cover.
Have that, like, scapegoat. Yeah, yeah. They have that whipping boy. They're like, oh, you know what? We don't want to cover these important people involved in this. Woody Allen. There we go.
Woody Allen. We know he's creepy. So it's people already aware of that. They're like, oh, Woody Allen's involved in this? That's a shock. But we're totally ignoring the four billionaires that are really at the heart of this story in the Virgin Islands.
Do you think at this point he's battle tested? Like, sure, call me a pervert. It's okay.
I mean, he's so insulated. And that's what these Hollywood people are. They're so insulated, right? Because people are going to continue to do his movies. And they're all protected. They all live in a freaking bubble. That's how this works.
Interesting.
Anyway, we've got more news to get to here on this Thursday. We are going to look at the debt ceiling and the economy on fire. Carol Roth is going to be joining us, the great Carol Roth. She wrote a great book that we've had Carol on the show before. She wrote a great book called
The War on Small Business. And she's got another book coming out called You Will Own Nothing. It's a fascinating premise. I haven't read it yet because it's due in July. But the premise is that she thought this World Economic Forum business was just conspiracy theory. And she is a former investment banker. She studies finance. And then all of a sudden she realized this is not conspiracy theory, it's conspiracy. And she has a book coming out talking about what we can do to stop globalists from taking our power of course I want to hear what she says, because like I said earlier, I feel hopeless every day when we're reporting this news. So what can we do? Yeah, let's listen in on that.
All right, we've got more news to get to here on the show. But first, are you an investor looking for an easier way to trade stocks? And would you like 20 free stocks? You know, I'm an investor in a lot of these commodities companies. I love investing in gold and silver producers and different mining companies. And I want to stay up to date on all the news with these companies. I'm watching these IPOs of different gold companies, and I want to make sure, because that's where I invest in, not only in the actual tangible gold and silver, but I also invest in the companies that are actually pulling it out of the ground. And with Moomoo, our favorite trading platform, there's no steep learning curve. It's a simple trading interface, easy to use, so even beginners can take advantage of the stock market in no time. Plus, it offers powerful tools, often reserved for experienced investors, like customizable watch lists, advanced charting capabilities. And Moomoo has zero commission trades, and the app looks amazing on every platform, from iOS to Android to Windows and Mac. You can get 20 free stocks right now when you open your account and make your initial deposits. Even if you never do anything else with the account, you can keep those free stocks and watch them grow. So open your free Moomoo account today. Right there, there's the URLs right on your screen. It's redacted.inc/Moomoo, and that's M-O-O-M-O-O. So redacted.inc/Moomoo to get your account set up, make your initial deposits. Again, that URL is redacted.inc/Moomoo.
Well, the U.S. is about to hit a debt ceiling, and we're losing track of how many times this happens. On average, 2-3 times a year now. Small banks are failing and on the brink across the country, and the dollar is losing its power globally. These things are clearly not unrelated. And today we have, my favorite financial expert to break this down for us. Carol Roth is the author of the book, The War on the Small Business. The War on Small Business. You can see it in over her shoulder there. Before the pandemic was over, Carol Roth was on the show, and she warned us that world governments were taking advantage of the situation to consolidate power and wage war on the small guy, all in the name of control. Carol, thanks for joining us at this junction that we find ourselves at right now. First of all, if you'd like to say I told you so, I'm going to welcome you to say that, and then give us some context about where we are now and how you saw this coming.
Yes, I mean, I did tell you so, and I'm going to tell you even more so. I have a new book coming out called You Own Nothing that I've been deep in the research for. And the reality is that this has all been very, very predictable. If you think about empires and financial cycles, they have starts and stops to them. Here in the United States, you know, we're the center of the global financial universe. And for most of us, we've kind of lived through this period of prosperity, and we've never seen anything different. So it's very difficult for us to imagine that we wouldn't be the financial center of the universe. But the reality is that before us, it was the British, and before the British, it was the Dutch. And, you know, way back in the day, the Roman Empire was the big financial empire. So these things kind of go in cycles. And, you know, not only have I seen this, and many other people have too, but the wealthy and well-connected have as well. So they have been jockeying to try to put themselves on top, to try to control all the finite resources. And in the process, you know, if you feel like you're saving, or but you just can't get ahead and you can't buy things, you know, that's not intentional. We were told you will own nothing by 2030. That's the top prediction coming out of the WEF. And so when you start seeing the wealth being consolidated, you know, at the top and everybody else struggling, that is not by accident.
And so you wrote in your last book that the government does this because it doesn't like small town entrepreneurs, because they can't control that. What they want to do is consolidate power to fewer large corporations that they can control. Now, we saw that happening right in front of our very faces this week when a small bank collapsed and those assets were just rolled right into JP Morgan Chase. It becomes clear that it's not about, oh, these were just bad decisions and all of a sudden this is a bad outcome. What you're saying is this is deliberate, right?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, this happened after the Great Recession financial crisis as well with the Dodd-Frank regulations. They were so onerous that you didn't have small community bank formations. You had a bunch of them close. A lot of that business went to the big banks. There was less small business lending, more big bank lending. So this is kind of that that history rhyming, if you will. If you take something like J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon, this is not his first rodeo. He knew exactly how to navigate this. So not only do you have this great consolidation where all of these regional banks are being folded in, but at sweetheart deals, Jamie Dimon is able to say, these are the good assets that I want to take. And, you know, the stuff that's being challenged, we're going to put over here. But if we back up and we say, what is the cause of this? You know, this is negligent, destructive Fed monetary and government fiscal and other policy that has enabled this. It didn't just come out of nowhere. This was too much risk in the system, too much money for the system to handle, the Fed changing course. So they're the ones that created this situation. They didn't have to go about it that way. And so certainly if you're a bigger bank, you have the scale to absorb that. And if you're a smaller bank, you get caught up in the same bad decisions the bigger banks made, but they had, again, more scale and diversification to absorb that.
But they are fighting for their lives for small things. For instance, the way I found you was the Wealthability podcast with Tom Wheelwright. Mm-hmm. Tom also had a small banks, someone who lobbies or represents them on the same show, talking about how they're fighting back against the IRS to not report microtransactions. They're fighting back about tracking and things like that. So this is a good example of what you say, is that the small banks are trying to be responsible and they're not being allowed.
Yeah, they're trying to be not only responsible, but responsive to their customer base. And they're the ones who are the advocates for the little guy. They're the ones who care and have the capacity to do small business lending, to do small individual lending. When you get to the big guys, they're not going to care. They're going to focus on their biggest customers and everything else kind of goes to the bottom. So this is that balance, that check and balance in the system. And when that goes away, you know, it's not only less choice for us, but it ends up meaning less freedom and less wealth creation opportunities for the average American.
So the way this is shaping up as a fight next week is Republicans want spending cuts in order to agree to increase the debt limit, and Democrats say no spending cuts. So is it a case of Republicans actually have in mind a responsible fiscal policy and Democrats do not? And will this, you know, is there a way to sort of like, you know, be more responsible financially in the United States in order to fix this?
Yeah, well, the idea that we have this debt ceiling or limit is kind of laughable. It's been modified more than 100 times since the end of World War II, and we've racked up $31.7 trillion. So the ceiling or limit really isn't working. We have to go back and find a different way to attack overspending. And I think that that's what that they're trying to do in terms of the Republicans. Now, we've gotten to this point because of both Democrats and Republicans. You know, I don't care who wants to take the credit for it now, although Republicans do seem to be leading the charge. But if we were to just roll back spending to 2018 or 2019 levels, we would actually have a net surplus and we could start paying down debt. But the current fiscal trajectory is totally unsustainable. And that's leading us to this precipice of a new financial world order and all of these issues that we're facing.
Right. And that's actually something I shared that tweet that you did the other day about how you're starting to think this ceiling concept isn't working.
Yeah, not so much. Not so much. It's I haven't seen a ceiling that has a giant hole in it that, you know, lets you get $31.7 trillion racked up underneath it.
Right. And you just keep going. Now, about your new book, You Will Own Nothing. This is a now famous line from the World Economic Forum that's come to refer to globalists' plans to disenfranchise everyone and consolidate power. It's not just in the United States. And in your book description, you say you once thought this was conspiracy theory, but now it seems to be playing out as real conspiracy. So can you take us through that journey of like, no, that's crazy talk to, oh my God, it's real?
Yeah, I mean, you hear that there's no way that this organization, the World Economic Forum, that's littered with the politically connected and the business elite would be advocating for the end of private property. Like, that just sounds insane to, you know, those of us who are normal people. But when you go and do the research, I mean, it's just right out there in front. There's an article that was on the WEF's website that this was derived from. Then they did this predictions, the, you know, top eight predictions for 2030, which, by the way, is not that far away. And it's the number one prediction that they have. And when you start to kind of connect the dots, I mean, even something like a new world order or a new financial world order sounds conspiratorial, but Joe Biden was talking about that in front of the business roundtable in a March 2022 speech. So, you know, these are not things that actually are rooted in any conspiracy. It's rooted in sort of human nature and time and economic cycles. And the reality is you can connect the dots on everything from social credit and business social credit, otherwise known as ESG, CBDCs. I mean, even big tech, if you think about what they're doing, everything is sort of renting your life back to you. Your life has become a subscription or a service. You don't actually own anything. You know, I've got this wonderful phone right here, but what do I own if I don't have access to the operating system, or they don't let me access my email or my payment services? I don't really own anything. And I know, as a financial expert that's been helping people preserve the American dream, ownership and ownership of assets that can increase in value over time is the underpinning and foundation of wealth. So if you don't have property and you don't have property rights, you don't have that opportunity to create wealth.
So then you say in your book that it is an essential guide to stopping the elite's agenda and taking control to preserve you and your family's freedom and wealth. So how can we fight back? I will read your book. But, you know, I guess what I'm asking for, is there a way to fight back? You have hope, maybe more than I do.
Yeah, I mean, so the way the book is set up is the first 10 chapters are really empowering you with knowledge, because it's very difficult to fight back unless you kind of go deep on what's happening and why it's happening. And then, ironically, chapter 11, which is usually associated with bankruptcy, is now the opposite. It's about owning everything. And so it's about making behavioral shifts, both in terms of what you do financially, as well as what, how you approach, you know, everything from your communities on down, to make those shifts so that you have more individual ownership. So can you individually stop the new financial world order, the new global order? Absolutely not. But can you take personal responsibility and say, okay, if this is happening, how do I implement capital preservation strategies? How do I own more hard assets that will leave me in a position that if, you know, the dollar is no longer the global reserve currency, and, you know, my dollars aren't worth what they were, that I have a different kind of a store of value? So I really go into depth on all of those different things, because at the end of the day, they may want you to own nothing, but I want you to own everything.
I love that. Well, thank you so much for coming on to tell us about your new book. I'm excited to read it. I've pre-ordered. You can follow Carol on Twitter and follow her, the books on Amazon. Is there anywhere else you'd like to tell us to find you?
Yeah. I mean, again, the book, you can get at bookshop.org if you want to support small business, or anywhere else. Amazon's great for rankings, but it's out 7/18. You can get it in your hot little hands day one to be empowered with that knowledge. And yeah, Twitter is sort of the best place to find me, as we are often connected, Natalie.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Well, thank you again for your time.
Thanks so much.
Well, I want to thank Carol for joining us. She is always the person that I go to when some big economic news breaks, because I'm like, help me understand this. Yeah. Also, she does so with a sense of humor. And so even though she's writing about these things that are serious and terrifying, at least she's got a good wit about her. And I appreciate that. If you'd like to follow her on Twitter too, you can do so. It's Carol J.S. Roth on Twitter. And you can find out more about her books there as well.
Yeah, her new book comes out soon. So thank you to Carol. Great to have her back on the show. All right, we've got more news to get to here in a moment. Juan Guaido, the fake president of Venezuela, was in Washington, D.C. He's like sort of the puppet of the West. He is, of course, his legacy is having stolen billions of dollars from that country, and why he's able to just like travel freely right into Washington, D.C. We're going to speak with Dan Cohen, who is literally the only journalist in the room to ask tough questions of his people in the room at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. So Dan's going to join us in a moment. But first, a lot of you are asking, hey, where do I get some of your merch? And we have a store. It's redactedstore.com. And we have mugs and t-shirts, and it helps support independent journalism. Most of all, you know, you can get something great maybe for Mother's Day or Father's Day. But it also supports us, what we do here on this show. It supports independent journalism. So our t-shirts, our mugs, if there's anything you want to get for mom, anything for dad for Father's Day coming up. I love my gray hat right there coming up here on your screen at the lower part of the screen. That's my dog walking hat, my redacted sort of floppy vintage style. I love that vintage style washed look. So that's my new favorite hat right there. You can grab it all if you go to redactedstore.com. Once again, redactedstore.com. Well, Venezuelan opposition leader or figure Juan Guaido, a man who, by the way, referred to himself as the president of Venezuela. Wouldn't that be nice? Just one day you wake up and you declare yourself president. Well, he was at the Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., one of the many think tanks that comprise the sort of permanent war brain trust, the military-industrial complex brain trust. Dan Cohen was there. Sparks were flying. People trying to throw and hurl some insults and questions at Juan Guaido. I've seen some of these amazing videos online and people being hauled out of there. You were there. What happened, Dan? Take us through this event. Who is Juan Guaido, and why were people so angry?
Yeah, Clayton. So as soon as Juan Guaido, the former self-appointed so-called president of Venezuela, as soon as he started speaking, the whole event went off the rails. Protesters from the anti-war group Code Pink interrupted him. Watch this.
Juan Guaido, eres un mentiroso, un ladrón, un
traidor.
Regresa a Venezuela para enfrentar la justicia. Juan Guaido is a traitor, he's a thief.
Liar!
He needs to go back to Venezuela to face justice. It's been 3 years since Operation Guinea.
Liar! Liar, you're paid by the Venezuelan dictatorship! You are paid by the Venezuelan dictatorship!
This guy is repudiated by all Venezuelans. He has no support in the country. It's ridiculous that he's not a Democratic leader by any means. He's not a Democratic leader. We're Venezuelans going to lose Cinco because of this guy right now.
Hey, here you'll see one of Guaido's fellow coup plotters, David Smolansky, actually dragging a Code Pink protester out, even putting him in a chokehold. And this protester is much smaller than Smolansky, as you can see, and also much older. So this looks to me like a pretty clear-cut case of assault. And the Wilson Center apparently is perfectly fine with allowing guests to self-deputize as security and assault people who interrupt their events. So Guaido got to speaking after the protesters were dragged out. He talked about how the maximum pressure campaign sanctions that the Trump administration took to a much higher level. These actually began with the Obama administration when Obama declared Venezuela as a national security threat to the United States. And then the Trump administration, when it decided to go along with the coup attempt, brought to a whole nother level and completely cut off Venezuela from the international economy. So Guaido talked about how this maximum pressure campaign to oust President Nicolas Maduro failed. And he said that if he goes back to Venezuela, that he will be imprisoned. And he compared himself to the Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. Now, Guaido is accused of treason in Venezuela. Keep in mind, he has been in Venezuela for years, attempting to lead a coup, calling on the military to defect, all while flying in and out of the country to the United States, to Europe, and he was never once touched by the police. They knew exactly where he lives. They know exactly where he lives. There was no hiding. And so thanks to the U.S., Guaido and his collaborators are in the process of embezzling some $8 billion from Citgo, which is the American corporation based in Houston, Texas, that is owned by the Venezuelan government that processed Venezuelan oil. And it's likely to be a lot more as this embezzlement scheme that they're running goes on. There's also roughly $2 billion worth of gold that the Bank of England stole from Venezuela to give to Guaido and his collaborators. So they've pillaged Venezuela, and the authorities have never touched this guy.
It is amazing. I saw, you know, a bunch of people in that room, a bunch of different reporters that I trust were there. And, you know, it's amazing to see Max Blumenthal. I love this comment. He said, Guaido's legacy is the theft of billions from the Venezuelan state by imperialist powers and the deprivation of millions. That's his legacy. And everyone knows that this money has been stolen. Everyone knows that this is the case and untouched by authorities.
Yeah, there's no one that better represents the pillaging of Venezuela than the leader of Guaido's party called the Popular Will Party. His name is Leopoldo Lopez, and he's actually a much more important figure than Guaido himself. He actually handpicked Guaido from the lower ranks of their party to be the frontman for the coup attempt in 2019, supported by the Trump administration. And Lopez now lives in one of the wealthiest neighborhoods in Madrid. There's a photo of him in this high-end Madrid restaurant that went viral to highlight how well he's living while Venezuelans suffer under sanctions that he supports. So I actually caught up with Leopoldo Lopez. He was there. So watch this exchange with him.
So to this point, when Mr. Guaido called on the military to support him as president, that didn't work. Now the opposition seems to be moving on without Mr. Guaido, and even the Biden administration has authorized Chevron to buy Venezuelan oil again. So how is your party relevant outside of this room, and what is the next step that your party will take to try to seize power?
Well, unfortunately, our political party, now that you mentioned it, Voluntad Popular, is the most persecuted organization in Venezuela. So we've tried everything. So I think it's futile to identify one or another way of addressing this very complex problem as the right or wrong solution, because there is a false dilemma many times around Venezuela and other countries between maximum pressure and no pressure at all. Well, some people would argue maximum pressure didn't lead to a transition to democracy. That might be true, but did no pressure led to transition to democracy? No, it hasn't either.
So Leopoldo Lopez basically acknowledged that their party has failed, their coup attempt has failed, and they're incredibly unpopular even among the opposition parties. He did not negate anything I said there. So these guys promised that they'd be able to overthrow the Venezuelan government with the full fury and backing of the United States, even putting a bounty on Maduro's head. And they're living high on the hog in Washington, D.C., in Miami, in Madrid. And, you know, Lopez swears that Venezuela is a dictatorship, this horrible dictatorship. But when I asked him, well, then why was Guaido never once arrested, even though he's accused of treason for attempting to lead a coup d'etat? So listen to this.
If Venezuela was under this dictatorship that you described, why is Mr. Guaido not in prison? He was able to walk around freely and declare himself president, which obviously the Maduro government rejected. So why was he not sitting in prison, tortured and persecuted, as you described?
Well, he's not in prison today because he was not caught by the dictatorship.
They couldn't catch him?
They couldn't catch him, and
they knew where he lives. They know where he lives.
But he had been in hiding for weeks before he left Venezuela.
But I'm talking about for years. I mean, it was years ago that he declared...
Well, you should ask the dictatorship.
The intelligence could not find
him
for
years? Well,
let me tell
you something.
Are they that incompetent that they could not find Guaido
for
years?
Let me tell you something. It's not me that I'm saying that. It's not me. So let's... It's
important. He's walking around as a free man. Saying he's persecuted by the dictatorship.
Yes, he is.
And is the intelligence really that incompetent that they couldn't find him in all of Caracas?
You can ask Maduro about that.
Yeah, the intelligence community has no idea where this guy is. And it also legitimizes Juan Guaido, this idea, the author of two failed military coups, like that the West will protect him at any lengths. I think I even remember France going to great lengths to protect him at the French embassy in Caracas. And so these Western leaders and these Western countries with their intelligence apparatus are all intertwined, but they don't seem to know where the guy is. They just have no idea where he is. I find it laughable.
Yeah, I mean, you just it's amazing. They just, Leopoldo López must think I'm dumb, or must think most people are dumb, or they just go along with it. The idea that they couldn't find him, the most incompetent intelligence officials ever, but they're so brutal, but they're incompetent. Like,
right.
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. And, you know, I was the only, there were no other reporters there calling this out who had anything to say. There were the protesters who said, you guys are liars, which is true. But I was the only journalist there who had anything to say, which any questions, which, you know, I think says everything about the Beltway Press Corps, that they're all subservient. They're all just going to go with the headline that, Guaido fears he could be arrested if he returns to Venezuela. And it's like, no, that maybe they will arrest him. Who knows? But to this point, they never did. And frankly, he committited treason. So it would make perfect sense for the government to arrest him.
And I would love to know who foot the bill for him to come to Washington, D.C. and be a part of this this think tank speech as well. You know, was it U.S. taxpayers, the intelligence community, is the Wilson Center itself? Like, I would love to know how this trip is arranged and put together. It's amazing. The people that the Wilson Center invites to sit on its panels. Dan Cohen, thank you so much for covering this, going there, being the only journalist in the room to ask tough questions. We really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thanks. Thank you, Clayton.
Unbelievable that this guy can like travel around freely. Like, the United States just welcomes Juan Guaido into a think tank in Washington, D.C. Like, oh, you stole billions from the Venezuelan people?
That's cool.
Come to America. Totally fine. Come to America.
Hey, stealing billions from people is an American tradition.
That's
so
right.
We welcome anybody that can. If you steal $200, you're going to jail.
That's
if
right.
You steal a billion, you're our
show
you're
us
our
how
hero.
That's done.
Well,
yeah.
And Nancy Pelosi, of course, was a huge fan of Juan Guaido. So, you know, that's her house. That's her place. Those are her peeps right there in Washington, D.C. Come on in. Come on in anytime.
Although, you know, our tax code does say that if you steal money, you have to report it. So. You know,
I wonder if he does that in Venezuela. I don't know.
Yeah, that's fine.
It's like the old Chicago drug tax. You know, like if you right. if you illicitly sell drugs, you still need to report it on your taxes.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Exactly.
They got Al Capone, right?
Right. No, not quite. But yes. Yeah. You didn't report these illegal drugs. You need to go to what's the name of the place in San Francisco? The prison?
Azkaban.
I know, that's literally what yes, I was getting. Yes. I'm like, no, that's wrong.
Alcatraz.
It's Harry Potter. That's not right. What is it? Alcatraz.
Alcatraz. That was literally.
The famous Azkaban prison in San Francisco.
Where
only Sirius Black has yeah. successfully escaped.
The Dementors.
That's right.
Well, we want to thank you.
Hagrid got out. Sorry.
Oh, yeah, Hagrid got out.
Hagrid was let out.
Let out, yeah.
He did not escape.
Okay, we have a community. If you'd like to support independent journalism and what we do here, not only if you go to redacted.inc on the left side of your screen, you can click on and sign up for our newsletter. The right side of your screen, you can become a part of our locals community, our redacted community here, and become a Rebel VIP. And for the price of a cup of coffee once a month, you can subscribe. You can be a part of our community where you get access to early videos, live streams that we're doing just for our viewers early, just for our community members, as well as released videos that will come to you before anywhere else. Some of our interviews. In fact, we've got a really exciting interview coming up that you as a redacted Rebel VIP will get access to before anyone else gets access to this interview. It's a big, big interview. We're really excited about it. But if you're a member of our private community, then you get access to that interview first. That's right. So redacted.inc, you can become part of our community there just for the price of a cup of coffee once a month. If you'd like to support independent journalism, you can do that. Again, this show is totally free, so we don't ask anything of you. You do not have to subscribe and become part of our community. You don't have to do that. But if you'd like to, you can do that. And if you can't afford it, and I totally understand that, things are tough right now, all we ask is that you hit that like button. And subscribe to the show. Again, that's totally free. You can follow us and subscribe. That is totally free. You don't have to pay anything to be a subscriber on YouTube or Rumble. But again, if you do want to support our community, you can do that for a few bucks a month. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All right, everyone. Thank you guys so much for joining us here on this Thursday. We really, really appreciate it. We'll be back on Monday streaming live at 4 p.m. Eastern time. That's when we do this show. So join us 4 p.m. Eastern time on Monday. Until then, everyone, have a wonderful, wonderful weekend. And we'll see you back here next week.
Bye then.